I'm Catherine Gunn, former GCHQ whistleblower, about the NSA GCHQ spying operation of before the Iraq War. So, how are you, Tony?
Yeah, not too bad, Catherine. Now, we've got a big event coming. All world leaders, apart from the Queen, apart from Putin, apart from President Xi, there's a bit of disappointment that they're not coming to Glasgow for COP26. But it does seem as if there's a major international coming together of minds over how to deal with the so-called climate crisis. I suppose the best way to start is, you know, how big is this crisis and how real is it?
Okay, well, for me, the whole, global political, all of these kind of gatherings and conferences and meetings and so on, it's all theater, in my point of view. It's the whole thing is just, a kind of great big show on the world stage to generate the media narrative that something has to be done, and look at all the world leaders gathering to discuss it. And this has happened over and over and over and over and over and over, and the narrative continues along the same vein that the big boogeyman is CO2, and it's how to control CO2. And that, for me, is the whole sham of current science that is presented to the public. And I was going to bring up a concept that I haven't delved into really, but that I really think is a very articulate way of explaining what's going on. There's a journalist and medical investigative researcher called John Rappaport, and he has a blog called No More Fake News. And over the course of the last 2 years, I began by looking at what he had to say about the COVID narrative. And, it made me feel reassured that there wasn't really actually anything that terrible to fear, but also that the key point of his kind of understanding of what's happening, he describes it, I think, as the cult of one. The cult of one is basically it's the what humans generally like to, we fall into this. It's a deep-seated need, a psychological need of all humans to have one simple answer to everything. The cult of one is this narrative that you blame one thing for the ills of everything. You blame one person for the chaos of everything, the problems. And you worship one person or one ideology or one thing for the solution of all. It's always one single answer, right? This need, which creates this cult of one. And we see it repeated over and over and over. And so just briefly to go back as a right to reply a little bit to last week's show where your colleague Martin talks about, when he responded to my discussion with you about COVID. He says that, all of us tend to have this problem where we view the world from where we're sitting. And that's true. We do often fall into that, seeing everything from our own small perspective. But I also think we need to actually pull further back from that and look at the world past our ideological blinkers. You know, so that means people who tend to see this whole thing as a potentially as a bioweapon, that also falls into the trap of the cult of one, because you're blaming, you're still describing the cause of all the problems, all the deaths, all the illness as a bioweapon. You know, so the choice, it seems, at the moment presented in most of the alternative and mainstream media is, A, you either believe that this all the death, all the illness is caused by this single novel coronavirus, or which is, you know, occurred in a wet market and jumped across species, which is a nonsense. Or you blame it on a bioweapon, which is apparently has managed to spread somehow or other across all the world. The reality is it's not nearly as simple as that. The answer is not nearly as simple as that. And we can see from the research done in the UK that the cause of death is multiple things. It isn't just one novel coronavirus. It's the prescriptions of lethal doses of drugs like midazolam or remdesivir. It's the withdrawal of treatment from those who require it. It's the excessive use of ventilation on patients that don't require it. And so on. You know, there are multiple causes for death and illness. And if you look at places like China and Iran and Cuba, and you think, well, okay, why are they also following the narrative? Why do they also have vaccines? Well, we don't know what's actually going on in their national governments and what they're trying to cover up or what they're trying to push forward. So I think, you know, in order to have a more balanced view is to kind of let go of your ideological blinkers and see all national leaders as potentially corrupt and potentially trying to better their own very self-centered interests. I'm not necessarily saying he's wrong. I'm not necessarily saying he's wrong about that this potentially could be a war, a asymmetric war on China. That's possible. I'm not saying that that's not true. But blaming it all on, you know, the fact that it's a bioweapon or a naturally occurring virus is falling into that trap of the cult of one. So bringing it back to the climate narrative, the climate narrative is a perfect example of the cult of one, because the one thing that has been blamed for all the complex ills of climate change, if that is actually a thing itself or a man-made thing, is one thing, carbon dioxide. That's just far too simplistic. But the cult of one narrative is so easy to promulgate. You know, having that one thing to blame is, you know, as you know, Tony, as a journalist, when you're trying to sell a story, is it easier to sell it if you've got one thing that you can focus on, or is it easier to sell it if you've got to bring in lots of different competing points?
What I'd say is it's certainly easier to sell it if you've sensationalized. That's one of the things I see a lot is, you know, creating a kind of hysteria around a story. And that's something which is the whole COVID thing. And the COP26 seems to be in common between the two. And I think the actual evidence backing up both as big, devastating, you know, massive crises that the whole world has got to come together. It does seem as if there's a similarity between the two. And we're being really told that, well, we're going to have some kind of big international response with all world leaders agreeing. And this has got its own kind of agenda, which, of course, is centralization of power.
Yes. Exactly. And the players behind these two narratives are intertwined and interlinked. You know, I mean, as our friend Klaus Schwab pointed out very early in the beginning of the COVID crisis, was that the Great Reset was very much... Well, the COVID-19 pandemic response was a great place to fulfill the Great Reset. And in fact, you know, they had last year, the World Economic Forum had a conference, a Zoom conference, and our own esteemed Prince Charles spoke at it. Yes, it was all about how they could use this amazing opportunity, as devastating as it was for the world economy and society. But it was for them, it was continuing to be a great opportunity for them to restructure the world. Restructure the way financial systems work, and restructure the way society works. And, you know, and as everybody, even on the left, is perfectly aware of, this is, you know, the classic example, in a way, of disaster capitalism. I don't have the expertise to kind of unpick all of that, and, you know, the argument that actually the capitalism that we see today, which basically I think, and probably certain economists would agree, that sort of began with the neoliberal era of unfettered capitalism from the sort of late 70s onwards, it's not a really free capitalism. It's not free trade in the true sense of the word. It's beginning to look like ever more so as a kind of kleptocratic, monopolistic crony capitalism, which is squeezing out innovation, squeezing out the little guys and gals, squeezing out local businesses, local one of the principal examples of that was when I was living in the UK. I remember for a while getting these plastic bags, you know, sort of charity bags stuck through our doors. I don't know if you're still getting them. These charity bags weren't a well-known specific charity collection. There was just a little slip of paper in it saying, please put all your secondhand clothing and so on into these bags, and they'll be redistributed to those in need. And I think eventually it came out that this was a massive sort of project where they were taking all these sacks and sacks of secondhand clothing from the US, from the UK, and presumably other places as well, other countries, and just taking them to Africa and selling them in street markets in Africa at, you know, really, really cheap prices. And that had the effect of destroying local artisan, you know, African traditional fabrics and designs and clothing. Anyways, I digress. But this kind of capitalistic system, it's reached a point where they feel the World Economic Forum and all those people who gather together and discuss all of these issues in meetings, some of them open, some of them, many of them secret, how they can continue to, how they can entrench their positions and, you know, cement them in for good so that they're never going to be jeopardized. One of the researchers that has best exposed this, I think, and if people are not aware or have maybe forgotten about her for a while, Corey Morningstar, who has her own blog, The Wrong Kind of Green, and I think she has another one as well called something like The Annihilation of All, that I can send you a link if I can find it, of that. She's, you know, best described this, of how the environmental movement was hijacked and corporatized, and it's all basically for the furtherance of financial markets and financial interests, and none of it is going to benefit any, you know, anybody. It's not going to, well, not the hoi polloi like us, and it's certainly not going to benefit the indigenous peoples who are, you know, living in all of the parts of the world where nature is still to this day more intact than anywhere else in the world. And so, of course, part of this green agenda and the Great Reset and the Green New Deal and so on is to financialize nature and to put a price on every living thing on the planet, to commodify it so that it can be traded and, you know, carbon offset against and so on. So she really goes into great detail about all of these things and is well worth reading her blogs.
Yeah, okay, so we've got Charles Saxicoba Gotha, I suppose we should really call him. It's the family's name before World War One, and Klaus Schwab. They are, you know, both very much part of this World Economic Forum, which interestingly has been doing important partnership deals with the United Nations that look as if the World Economic Forum might actually be the senior partner in that deal, which to me looks like it might be a kind of hostile takeover bid of the UN. Obviously, it's quite an important institution, even though it's deeply flawed. And so also with the World Health Organization, also part of that, we do seem to be seeing a centralization of power, a kind of privatization in a way of the UN. Mm. But I'm not so sure that, you know, certainly when it comes to COP26, that the other superpowers such as, you know, China and Russia are really going to be going along with this.
Right, and I think this is where there is some hope, in that, you know, the Anglo-American sort of cult, as it were, in the zero COVID and the zero carbon cult, it's anti-human and it's anti-science. And ultimately, the, you know, there are still genuine scientists who have not been corrupted by, you know, large funds from influential organizations and corporations, who are, you know, going to present data and information that shows, you know, exposes the lies. And yeah, Russia, you know, a freezing cold country like Russia and many parts of China cannot survive on wind power and solar power for keeping their public, you know, their populations warm through the winter. I mean, interestingly enough, in Turkey, it's only in the last few years that Turkey has actually started piping gas and retrofitting homes with gas central heating. In the very coldest parts of Turkey. I mean, most people, I guess, presume that Turkey is a hot place, you know, because of the summer tourism and the Mediterranean coast. But the Mediterranean coast is a microclimate. There is a mountain chain that basically blocks the coldest weather, protecting the Mediterranean coast so that it remains fairly temperate throughout the winter. But the bulk of Turkey, I'd say about 80% of Turkey, gets even colder than the UK. You know, there are parts of Turkey that drop to below 20 in the winter routinely. So up until, you know, not so long ago, most people in those parts of the world burnt coal. You know, if coal burns for a long time, it keeps the stoves warm for a long time. And people lived in one single room in their house throughout winter because maybe they could only afford to heat one single room in their house. So they eat, sit, and sleep in one single room. And it's only very recently that under this kleptocratic government, but they have at least started to, you know, pipe gas into all of these very cold regions now. And most people are delighted by it because for the first time they can utilize all of their house, you know, and everywhere is warm.
That's Russian gas, so I guess, is it?
Yes, I think so, which is why Turkey is on this, is in this kind of walking this tightrope between being a NATO partner and also but depending on Russia for its economy, basically. So the reality for the majority world, let's say, is very practical. And the Anglo-American cult of trying to force through these insane policies that will drastically reduce the standard of living for hundreds of millions of people across US, UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Now, anyone who's falling into line on this narrative is going to see their lives deeply uncomfortable and unpleasant. But they're not going to say that, obviously, are they? I mean, they can't. Nobody would agree to this if they were perfectly aware of what the outcomes were going to be. And that's where we need great researchers and great investigative journalists in exposing this. But of course, the Anglo-American cultists, their next move is to basically shut down, shut down anybody who's trying to investigate and expose what's going on. So the online censorship and the online harms bill and all these legislative pieces that will further, you know, hamper people. So it's, you know, it's a race. It's a race to get people to see what's going on before things are too tightly sewn up.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound quite frightening, actually, the idea that, you know, you can bamboozle, you know, half the world, if maybe even more than half the world. And that's at least the attempt that seems to be going on to impoverish people. I mean, it reminds me a bit of this whole Klaus Schwab meme, which is about having nothing but being happy. Well, you're happy, but you're not really happy, of course. You're in a permanent state of angst because you're not quite sure whether you're going to be cancelled by the regime at any point. I mean, how can you possibly be happy in that sort of situation? It just sounds bizarre. But, you know, you're talking about a particular type of capitalism, which seems kind of, you know, you might call it stitched up. You know, I would call it cartel capitalism, where you get, you know, massive kind of contract fraud, where bids, well, it's not really, in a way, it's not fraud, because with all the big bids, whether it's to do with arms, civil engineering or whatever, are simply part of a cartel. So one company in the cartel will win the contract, but all the work gets divided up amongst those other companies. And this is a bit reminiscent of Nazi Germany, actually, the big steel cartels. And so I don't know what, I'd be interested to see what you make of it, but one of the bits of research I did for my book, if I can plug that, which is called The Traitors of Arnhem, which looks at the origins of the Bilderbergers, is on page 29. There's a little excerpt from a guy called Idris Francis, who I met and who gave me some of the documents about his uncle, Captain Idris Evans, at the 1946 Nuremberg tribunals. He was escorting a German general who turned to him. He said, "Yes, you have beaten us for the second time, but next time we will win. Next time it will all take place so slowly that you won't know what's happening until it's all over." And, you know, I'm quite concerned that what we're dealing with here really is a kind of a financial Fourth Reich, a kind of, you know, cartel system, where actually the press and the media, the information, the lifeblood that we need to make decisions about, you know, if there is to be any democracy, obviously you need to know what's going on, that is really just become part of the cartel, you know, that this is all controlled and owned, and there isn't really any independent free thought within that.
Yeah, well, that is... That's spooky, isn't it? That's and I would agree. It's they've definitely, you know, they've been. It's clear now for those of us who've been awake, or I really don't like using that term awake, but who've been cognizant of what's been going on for the last. You know, I mean, I would say I've been cognizant for maybe, well, 20 years coming on now. But, you know, you keep learning new things and finding out new things as you go along. And anybody who's only just beginning to realize that something doesn't add up, you know, they've got a hell of a lot. It's overwhelming. It must be daunting and it's scary. Think for anybody who's only like maybe in the last year thought, hang on a minute, this surely this can't be right. So the nuts and bolts of it is, yeah, it's a corporate takeover of our government institutions and our organizations that are meant to be in the public and the people's interest. And as you say, you know, the takeover of the UN by WEF, and basically WEF is just all of the top industries and financial institutions, right? It's like all of them are members. So WEF isn't some think tank, as it were. It's basically like a Rotary Club of all the, you know, all the top 200 or 500 industries, corporations and so on. And again, yes, the World Health Organization, as you presented in last week's show, your doctor of the week, Dr. Wodak, you know, as he said, the World Health Organization, 80%, I think he quoted, of the funds comes from pharmaceutical corporations or organizations. So, you know, that's been taken over. And I think we've seen that the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, is also now compromised in one way or another. And so this is what happens. This is what, you know, this is why democracy is, you know, you can't just sit back on your laurels. You know, it's a participatory process, but in effect, we've been lulled. And I think Adam Curtis in his various documentaries goes into how, you know, the PR and marketing arm of industries and of government have connived to lull the population into servitude, almost, you know.
Particularly the power of nightmares and the century of the self, absolutely brilliant documentaries. But look, I think finally be interesting to look at what's happened in New Zealand, because this is often held up as they've done a wonderful job in New Zealand. But speaking to New Zealanders over the last few days, they're extremely disturbed by Jacinda Ardern's admission that there is going to be a two-tier New Zealand, where people who have had vaccinations and have got COVID passports are going to be able to do all sorts of things that those that haven't won't be able to do. So this is an absolute admission of a divided society running into the future. I mean, yeah. Without any definite end to it at all.
Yes, and it's insane. It's a nonsensical thing, because as everybody knows, and as they admit themselves, you know, the vaccines don't work. They're not effective. You know, they, Boris Johnson has said it. You know, any number of people have said that this vaccine doesn't prevent you from getting sick. It doesn't prevent you from passing it on.
No, but the argument that they use is simply that it mitigates against maybe going to hospital. So it means that if you do get ill, you're less likely to get seriously ill.
Yeah, but surely in that case, you're more likely to spread it to somebody. You know, there is no logic in any of their arguments, which is why they're being so bullish now, because they've got to the point where they can't argue with, and that's why they're trying to shut anybody down who presents the alternative, because they literally have no rationale, no logic behind any of their arguments. There's a lot to be concerned about, a lot to be, really quite afraid of. But it wouldn't work if people just simply did not comply. It's as simple as that. It might hurt for a week or two or a month of not complying, because, you know, you might have to tighten your belts and eat beans for the next week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But the alternative is much, much worse. And if everybody who basically thinks this stinks, whether they know what's going on or not, but simply thinks, I don't want to live in a two-tier system. I don't want to have to show my papers everywhere I go. Something doesn't add up. This doesn't make sense. Never mind the why. Just don't comply. And, you know, all the you know, healthcare workers or the nursing home workers, or the, I mean, it's even happened in General Electrics in the US, in one of the headquarters of, or maybe one of the offices of General Electrics in the US. They had a walkout of over 100, more than 100 employees who walked out against vaccine passports.
Well, I noticed also at very, well, of course, no publicity whatsoever, but hundreds of scientists at Los Alamos, the US nuclear maintenance and research for the nuclear weapons, they decided that they were going to defy the order for everyone to be vaccinated too. So they're, you know, you've got the potential there of nuclear weapons maintenance strike going on in the United wow. States, and yet no publicity for that.
Right. That's concerning. But, you know, that this is the reality, is that I think most people now can put their hand on their heart and say, I don't want to be forced into anything. And this, the realization that it isn't just, you know, the first two jabs, it's boosters for life, which, by the way, is a cumulative thing of, you know, toxic, you know, adjuvants, the toxic lipid nanoparticles, which there have never been any toxicology studies of those in the body. So this cumulative effect, no one knows what the result of that is. And yet they're telling people, you know, it's this booster, and potentially it's going to be like a flu vaccine, but it will be mandated and you'll have to have two a year and so on. When people finally cotton on to the fact that they're going to have to keep injecting themselves with these bizarre cocktails of things, you know, then it's time to say, I kept thinking, when will people draw the line? When will people say, I'm not going past this point? And it, you know, it's quite disturbing to see that it's actually gone this far. But it's, you know, in places, see, the UK hasn't got to that point yet, but in, well, apart from maybe Scotland, but in places like in European nations and in Australia, where they're literally saying now, you can't go to work without a jab, you can't do this and do that without a jab. And then you see massive resistance, right? Because people have definitely had enough now. So I have hope. You know, and I think this is maybe partly why the UK is holding back, because they want to stagger these movements so that they can, so that it's not kind of a worldwide uprising. But none of this is going on in anywhere else. It's, again, this is an Anglo-American centric sort of imposition of these mandates. And as I say, of testing of kids, healthy kids at school, again, it's an Anglo-American centric thing. And the talk about jabbing kids is again an Anglo-American centric thing. So that, you know, the rest of the world is not playing ball to that extent on these issues.
You mentioned Australia. I suppose we should finish by just a quick mention of Julian Assange, because he's hearing this week. You know, you gave us some your thoughts about him last week too, but we've got, incredible stuff happened with him, and we've got these various other types of organisations now who are giving out, you know, great big leaks and things, but they don't really seem to quite have what WikiLeaks had, which was this, you know, unashamed criticism, particularly of the, you know, Anglo-Zionist intelligence services and what they're capable of. For example, I think it was back in March 2017, the release of Vault 7 by WikiLeaks, which, I mean, for me, was a fascinating few days of going through some of that, where it talks about using cyber warfare and hacking to hack aircraft and bring them down and make crashes, you know, as a covert assassination method. The same exact thing with cars. And we saw just before that, didn't we, in 2013, the death of Michael Hastings, the US investigative journalist, in a very strange car crash where his car suddenly accelerated up to 80 miles an hour, even though he had his foot on the brakes. You could see, you know, he had the brake lights were on as he's accelerating, and then of course the car swerved into a tree and crashed and killed him. And all this, I mean, there was even the idea of, well, I'd say the idea, the capability to hack into railway locomotives and to get them to just wildly accelerate to crash a train, to make it look as if it was an accident. But actually, this is an assassination technique. So we're not seeing very much of this kind of thing anymore, are we?
Being exposed, you mean?
Yeah, the WikiLeaks is not doing this stuff, you know, because basically the whole operation has been concentrated on trying to keep Julian out of jail, and out of America, which, you know, it's quite obvious that that's where this is all coming to, as he quite rightly said back a decade ago.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. WikiLeaks has, I have to admit, I don't go on their website and I don't go through their things because I'm doing it on my phone and it's tiny and it's too small to see. But it is, they have obviously targeted anyone, and Julian Assange was one of the, you know, most notable examples of someone who really stuck their neck far above the parapet and pointing the finger. And so they really hammered it down. And I think that's, you know, clear for anybody who has been paying attention that, you know, the gross smearing of his character and the all the, you know, the false stories about his of character assassination, basically to try and cut off support for him, worked incredibly well for a very long time, and there's still a residual sense of that lingering behind. But you know that. Yeah, I'm afraid Julian Assange, I hope he gets, you know, this next week, and he gets a lot of support, a lot of people coming out you know, showing their support for him and his cause. Because
yeah, it almost seems that he's a sort of symbol of the absolute failure of the £1 billion London media, really, that, you know, the people that used to do this work, you know, spread across maybe 10 or 12 institutions, you know, both broadcast and print media, used to do this stuff back in, well, maybe not quite the same thing, but they certainly used to hold governments to account and hold the military to account to a certain extent. Anyway, look, just going back, finishing on the COP, I'd like to just plug I think, excellent, interesting, fascinating documentary. It's called The Great Global Warming Swindle, which was put out by Channel 4. I think it was around about 2010, which I rewatched that recently, which you're thankfully able and allowed to do these days. And I found that absolutely fascinating because, you know, what they're doing there is they're looking into, with a whole load of, you know, disaffected scientists who've lost their jobs because they've been critical of the climate science agenda. And of course, you can't see any of this anymore because all the major channels have basically said, including formerly the BBC, etc., have said that they will not have any critical voices. They actually formally said this, that they will not have people who want to critique the climate agenda because it's all so far, so important. The whole thing is so important that we can't go back there. We've already, the science is settled. So I just wondered if there's anything that you could point to that would be quite an interesting thing to be looking at to counter this, what is effectively an enormous amount of censorship going on.
Well, there is. It's even hard to find Yeah, I mean, they're scrubbing the data even of temperature, and they're altering, temperature charts, global temperature charts, in order to kind of make the last few years look like sort of excessive heating and so on. Yeah, I was going to go a bit more into the climate side of things, because it's an issue that I had paid quite a lot of attention to previously before COVID, and then sort of dropped off in the last 2 years. But I managed to, I only have a screenshot of this. I can't actually find it now on the website, but the NASA website, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, has had on their site a thing about computer climate models. And I think, you know, again, this is best exemplified as well by the ridiculous, outlandish COVID computer modeling. And, you know, the climate narrative essentially is based on these sorts of mathematical modelings, right? And this is what it says. Unfortunately, the margin of error is too large for making a reliable forecast about global warming. So they're talking about these mathematical equations and the modeling that goes on. A doubling in atmospheric carbon dioxide predicted to take place in the next 50 to 100 years is expected to change the radiation balance at the surface by only about 2%. Yet according to current climate models, even such a small change could raise global temperatures between 2 and 5% or 5 degrees centigrade, with potentially dramatic consequences. If a 2% change makes that much difference, a climate model must be accurate to within at least 0.5% to be useful. Thus, today's models must be improved more than tenfold in accuracy, requiring much more and much better data for developing a better understanding of climate models. That's just one little snippet of referencing the mathematical modeling of climate. And, you know, it's exemplified by, again, what Dr. Wodark was saying about, you know, the pandemic modeling and how these modelers assume that, for example, 600 infected individuals from Mexico or Brazil would get onto planes which were, you know, going in every different direction to every corner of the globe and, you know, thus transferring the epidemic across the world into a global pandemic. And that was, you know, kind of the assumptions of these hypothetical theoretical modelers. It's not based on reality. And one thing that, you know, does, I'm not sure many people are necessarily aware of this because it's quite niche, and I only know about it because I follow a YouTube channel called Suspicious Observers. Most of it is gobbledygook to me, but you know, the nuts and bolts of it is that our climate is very much predicated on what the sun is doing. And very basic kind of explanation of climate calculations, you know, some in a very simplistic sense is, you know, the equation basically is natural variables plus human interference equals climate change. But what, you know, what the scientists are trying to do is calculate the natural variables. And the natural variables are so complex And, you know, so there's so many natural variables that perhaps some of which they don't even know exist, many of which they don't know exist. You know, how can you calculate a equation when you can't pin down half of it? And in the latest modeling, so there was an event, and I know this has gone on extremely long, longer than last week, but in the latest sets of calculations, there was an event that caused climate scientists to realize they were missing some essential components of the natural variables. And that happened on my birthday. So on the 23rd of July, 2012, besides it being my birthday, do you have any idea what happened on that day?
No. Well, you got a birthday cake?
Well, yeah, presumably I got a birthday cake. But the what happened was that the Earth experienced a near miss of a solar superstorm. So what happened was the sun erupted, and it basically produced several powerful coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, which narrowly missed the Earth. What it didn't miss, however, what they didn't miss, was a spacecraft, a way out called Stereo A. And luckily that spacecraft didn't get destroyed, because it was far removed from the planet's magnetosphere, so it wasn't, you know, didn't result in any sort of electronic disruption. But it was able to gather data, and it was able to continue to gather data over that period. And what that showed was that the Earth was bombarded by massive amounts of particle forcing. You know, all kinds of radiation, X-ray, gamma ray, you know, just mind-boggling amounts of energy that could have bombarded the Earth, and it would have been, if it had been a direct hit, it would have been a Carrington class event, and the Carrington event happened in the 1890s, I think, and it knocked out all the telegraph poles, set fire to some of the stations. But at the point in history, the world wasn't massively electrified. It was still very localized, very specific. If it had happened like the Carrington event, if it had happened now, it would have knocked out most of the electrical grid systems of the world. We could have, it has the potential to. And that powerful, you know, massive charging of the planet from the sun previous. So what they realized then was that in their measurements of the sun's effect on the planet, they only measured previously the irradiance levels, so the ultraviolet radiation that the Earth received. And what happened in when they looked at the chart and they saw what happened on the 23rd of July 2012 was that there, instead of a massive peak, there was a pretty deep V-shaped dip on the chart, which meant negative radiance, right? Negative radiation of the Earth. So in climate calculation models, that would mean a deficit. So instead of adding to the natural variable, it was actually detracting from the natural variable. And then what would happen then would be that the human interference would have to be increased, because how do you account for that massive dose of energy if it's actually detracted from the equation, because the graph doesn't pick it up? So from that point onwards, they've realized that solar energy in terms of particle forcing is a major part of the equation and the natural variable. In the most recent modeling, they weren't able to include that. But going forward, in the next round of presentations in 2022, I think, those will have to be included, because they've recognized now that solar forcing has a much greater effect than they realized. This comes back to the point that where, you know, there are scientists who are doing real science, and that was a complete freak example. You know, it was a freak incident that this Stereo A spacecraft was actually specifically designed to measure solar activity, and it got a direct hit. So imagine how many times, you know, that's happened and it's been missed. Anyway, so eventually this sort of real science will filter down, and it will become part of the final presentation. And this is the, you know, when you get to the higher levels of the scientific debate, which is very rarefied and it's very specialized, it doesn't filter down to the common denominator level, which is then reproduced in the propaganda media. You know, that's why when they say things like carbon dioxide is the cause of global warming, you know, it's a joke, basically, because no scientist is saying that.
Well, there's actually lots of scientists saying it, particularly this whole sort of stable of climate scientists are saying that. And I wonder whether the, you know, things have got so controlled as they have, for example, in you know, in spheres like economics and other science, which, you know, there's a lots of people on the fringes of economics who would really criticize the mainstream, the same as in, you know, is in all sorts of things to do with climate science. The mainstream is a certain thing. And it looks to me as if actually what's happening is that the debate is being successfully stifled, where there are any scientists that come up with, you know, something which challenges this so-called consensus narrative simply lose their careers, and they're completely shut out of the profession.
Yeah, I mean, that is what seems to be going on, and what has been going on, what has been intensifying in the last 20 or so years. But, you know, we have to hope that human ingenuity, the human spirit, and the sort of genuine characters who rebel against this authoritarian, totalitarian system, you know, will come up with solutions. They may be more localized, and they may be more grassroots. They may be, again, asymmetric. I mean, we've got to think along the lines that, you know, of the methods that are being used against us. But I think, you know, that there are always consequences to any action, and that not necessarily they're not necessarily known, as it were, even by the planners. even by the planners who, you know, are probably prepared for various reactions, they can't possibly know all. And there are unintended consequences as well. So everything is still to be played for. And even if it isn't, even if ultimately there will be a brutal, harsh system 20, 30, 50 years down the line, does that mean we have to give up now? You know, absolutely not. I would say we still must persevere, and who knows what the alternative will be, because the last 2 years and the culmination of from the beginning of the internet is that more and more people are able to find out the truth for themselves, you know, and that was the sort of flowering of the democratic process, I think. And yes, of course, they're trying to tamp it down, and they're trying to nail it shut, because the hoi polloi have had a wild run of it, and, you know, and they're fed up now. They've had enough of the hoi polloi going wherever they want, and you know, filling up all the beautiful tourist hotspots around the world, you know, flying Jet 2 and EasyJet and all the various no-frills airlines to all corners of the earth. It's time we got put back in our place, according to these elitists at the top who think the world belongs to them, but because basically their concept is anti-human, fundamentally anti-life, it won't survive. It can't thrive, so it won't survive. That's my motto.
Yeah, so I just wonder if you know, that there is a sort of over obsession with short-termism up in Glasgow, and that what they've done is that they're storing up an increasing backlash, actually, by shutting out the real scientific debate and complete making sure that there is no opposition allowed. The wall-to-wall propaganda that we've been getting this week, all week, all over the TV about, you know, the climate crisis here, there and everywhere. And that actually might work against them ultimately. And that may be one of the reasons. I mean, certainly extremely controversial. What they're planning to do up there is to, you know, to alter human society right across the world. That's the plan, in order, you know, which it may have enormous effects in impoverishing people, and certainly taxing. I mean, we've just seen this tax coming in London of £4,500 a year for even disabled people to be able to travel around in their diesel cars, unless of course they're massively expensive brand new diesels, in which case they don't have to pay anything. You know, which seems very bizarre for a Labour to be imposing this. And there's all sorts of controversial consequences of what this whole climate agenda is promulgating. So maybe that's one of the reasons why the Queen is quite cleverly, well, I mean, you know, it may just be that she really was sick, but she seems to have found a very good excuse not to be there. Anyway, let's just wrap up with you saying what you think the ultimate consequence, whether they can actually do all this stuff, or whether you think it's just about creating crises that that they can hope to bring some sort of, you know, centralization of power out of these crises, whether they're real or not.
Well, far be it from me to, you know, look into the crystal ball, but I can't see, Tony, how, you know, I think it will get really, really messy and really bad, and a lot of people predict that. Very chaotic, but essentially their systems won't work. They won't work on a global scale. Not in lockstep as they wish. and maybe in certain places, but not across the globe. And they won't work because, you know, the automated systems don't work. We've already experienced how, you know, just calling through to a call center and being having our calls responded to by a bot or AI bot or whatever, rarely, if ever, seems to solve the problems that we have. So, you know, fundamentally, these AI systems will just create chaos. They'll cause more problems. They'll be hacked. They'll be, you know, there'll be massive data leaks and so on. And it will just be a nightmare scenario. I mean, most of the politicians and pundits don't really know what they're even espousing, and they don't know what the reality will be. And you know, and quite frankly, the people who are pushing forth these sorts of systems, I would argue that they're basically insane. They're criminally insane psychopaths. And we should not be cooperating with any of it. We should be complaining, tub thumping, you know, just really being uncooperative. And I know it's difficult and it's maybe not what most people are naturally inclined to do, but, you know, you wouldn't cooperate with a bully. You know, you would defend your child against a bully. So, you know, we're literally being bullied. And so, you know, it's time to stand up, even if it's uncomfortable, and just not go along with it.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.